Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend, Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired-looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1006. A couple things. First of all, I'm going to be performing at the Addison Improv, which is in Addison, Texas, just outside of Dallas. Or maybe is it inside of Dallas? It is Dallas adjacent. It's kind of an industrial, businessy area. I don't think anyone lives in Addison. I think it's just businesses, but there is an Addison Improv there, and I'll be there July 25, 26, and 27. And then, if you're in Raleigh, North Carolina, I'll be at Good Nights Comedy Club August 8, 9, 10. I don't believe I performed in Raleigh before, so I'm very excited about that. And this is tied into this episode, but I'm posting this a day early because I got to be a guest on Whose Line Is It Anyway because of this podcast that you're about to listen to, because of Wayne Brady, and you hear it unfold on this podcast. And it was a very big deal to me because the idea of it terrified me, because it's Whose Line is one of the most influential comedy things in my life. Will Wheaton and I, when we were roommates in the early 90s, used to watch the British version every day. I think it was on at 6 p.m. and it completely changed, expanded my horizons, changed, it was one of those pivotal moments where it changed, like, how I see comedy, and I absolutely was floored when because I tell a story about how I auditioned for Whose Line in the early 2000s, and then Wayne said, oh, you should just come on, and I was like, what? And I did it, and it was a blast. I think I did a pretty good job. There were a couple times where I could have done better, or like, I kind of fucked that up. But overall, I don't think I embarrassed myself, which is really what I was afraid of. But I did this because it was a lifelong dream, and I was terrified to do it. That made it very important to me. But everyone on the show was super nice. It was Proops, Colin, Ryan, Wayne, and Aisha, and it was an absolute dream. And the audience was incredible. The producers were great. The whole experience was fun. But I believe it's the season premiere tonight. This is Monday, June 17th. It's on the CW, so please watch it tonight. And also, support Wayne Brady. Watch Let's Make a Deal. Watch Whose Line. He was doing a run on The Bold and the Beautiful. He's writing books. He pitches some other shows during this podcast. He is inspirational, not just as a multi-hyphenate guy who does a bunch of stuff that he does, by the way, brilliantly. Everything he does, he excels at. And I don't know. Wayne and I have had sort of parallel, we're about the same age, and so we've had these sort of parallel careers, and we've always kind of seen and waved to each other from across different parts of our careers. But this was really, I mean, we have talked throughout the years. This is the first really long conversation that we've had, and I love him. And now we're friends. And as you hear in this episode, we might actually start doing some stuff together. So thank you to Wayne Brady for being a wonderful guest and a great dude, and for letting me experience one of my lifelong dreams. I'm sorry I'm laughing. It's ridiculous that it even got to happen. So Will had gotten to do it too. So that I think for both of us, it's, you know, this was a nice little bow on something that was so important to us. And so now, okay, so now that you know it's Wayne Brady, usually I do the corkboard up top, but now I'm going to do a couple of corkboards real fast before we get into the episode. First of all, events at id10t.com is how you get these in here. Kelsey writes, I'm a watercolor illustrator and expat from California. I recently moved to a rural area in France. Being in a more natural setting inspired me to do a 100-day painting challenge to learn about local flora and fauna around me. Along the way, I started researching biodiversity and habitat loss and how it affects literally everything and everyone on Earth. My 100-day project is on Instagram, and I sell original watercolor sketches of local French plants and animals on Etsy, where folks can support my research painting and help me better tell the story of the importance of natural science and biodiversity for all nature, including humans. Instagram is it's pronounced Kelsey, but it's spelled... It's the at, and then Q-E-L-L-E-S-S-I, and Etsy is the same shop name. You can purchase original artwork there, and she'll be adding little by little as the project continues. And I did look at it, and the work is beautiful. So great job, Kelsey, and way to go, just moving out to rural France and discovering nature and taking a chance like that. I have no doubt that this will pay off and take you in directions that you never, never, never could have foreseen. So congratulations. Also, Rachel writes, my husband and I are big-time listeners of yours. I know that you have public announcements before episodes and was hoping you were willing to help us. My husband has been diagnosed with end-stage kidney failure and is looking for donors. A live donor would greatly increase his lifespan and quality. If you could share this information, I'm sure that would reach far more people than we can hope for. So I am absolutely sharing it for you, Rachel, and I'm wishing all the best and hope that this works out. The more people that know, she says, the more likely chance we can find someone who's willing to donate. Contact info for donation questions, livingdonors@albertahealthservices.ca. And the phone number is 780-407-8698. That's 780-407-8698. I'm sure I speak for myself and all of the ID10T listeners that are sending you all the best and hoping that you can find a kidney for your husband, and we're thinking about you. So that is all for the corkboard. Events at ID10T.com again as we launch in episode number 1006 with Mr. Wayne Brady.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
We order and I give him my credit card and he goes, oh, I thought that was you. And I go, what? He goes, I used to be head of marketing for Sony and I did a show with you, a pilot with you years ago. And he said, I got, you know, like there were a lot of shifts in the business around 2009. And he said at 50, I got laid off. And he was like, I didn't know what I was going to do. I'd been in marketing for like 30 years or whatever. And so he called his friend Norman Lear, because he had worked for Norman Lear in the 70s. And he was like, I don't know what to do. And Norman was like, well, you pretty much, like, are you happy with your job? Is there anything else? And he's like, I don't know. I'm not really happy with it anymore anyway. And he goes, well, now it's time to do something new. And he just happened to have a passion for bread making. So he pursued it and opened this incredible bakery in this tiny little town called Los Alamos.
Los Alamos, where the nuclear testing, you know, stuff, right?
I think it's a different Los Alamos. There's a Los Alamos
in New Mexico.
And this Los Alamos is just off the 101.
Oh, okay.
And so there's like a little, it's kind of a vineyard area, and this tiny little town is sort of being revitalized by just like, you know, artsy creative types. So these old rundown places are now like boutique hotel, you know, like the old motels turn into like a boutique-y hotel.
That's cool.
And he opened this really incredible, I mean, it's like the fucking best bread ever. And it's called Well Bred. Well Bred, it's called. It's in Los Alamos. His name's Bob, and it was great.
Well, I'm glad it worked out for him, because it sounded like, coming in on the story, it sounded like this guy was in marketing and then was a waiter serving you.
No, it was his shop.
Well, then that's
great. It was his bread. It was his cafe, and you know, and also just such an interesting lesson. And like, oh my God, you know, like whatever direction you think your life is going, and then all of a sudden something changes, and it's like, well, I'm just going to do this other new thing now. So, I don't know. It was very inspirational.
Good for Bob.
But let's talk about you, Wayne Brady. How are you doing?
I love these glasses. I had these when I was a kid. Now, were these originals?
This is an original. That the one you have is a repro. But I have original Lando here. And you can see the shape of the glass is different.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Although, someone has pointed out that if you got the glass and hadn't seen the movie, the little exposition on the back gives up a lot of, it's a lot of spoiler.
Oh yeah, they did that in the on the cards too. Like as a kid, I remember having the Star Wars cards, and depending on which card you gave, it actually told you the movie.
Yeah.
It told you the exact thing.
I'm hoping that if you bought the card, you probably saw the movie. It's like, no one watches Talking Dead if they didn't watch Walking Dead. You know what I mean? It's like they probably – we can't spoil anything on the show because people are probably already in. But these are just random glasses. If you were just like, oh, I'm going to get some water. I sure can't wait to go see this Star Wars movie. God damn it. It's right here on the – yeah.
Never again.
He's very excited. He's very passionate. Were you a big Star Wars fan growing up?
Well, yes and no, and I think it's an interesting thing because I'm writing a book right now called Young, Gifted, and Whack.
Uh-huh.
About being a young black nerd from the hood, and you know, we've heard these stories in the 80s, of course, those of us that came of age, about being a nerd and the things that were accessible to you. People never talk about the kids who were nerds and never had the things that you went, oh, I want that Voltron standing, the 2 foot guy,
right.
Guy, but I can't get that. Oh, I want the Star Wars thing. Oh, I want to go see Star Wars, but I can't see that. So when we were talking about the glasses and the cards, from my perspective, I knew Star Wars the movie from the glasses from Burger King and from the cards that I got from different friends. And from reading some of the comic books, so I didn't see Star Wars proper until, really, I think I was 19, 20, 21.
Oh wow!
So I saw it after the fact, but I knew of it because I knew all of the lore and I had stuff that I got secondhand. So I never admitted to anyone that I'd never seen it. I just listened and played along and filled in the gaps so I could tell them everything what happened without ever seeing the movie.
Isn't it nice that nerd culture has sort of become such that it has permeated everyone has access to all of it now,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, the traditional archetype of the nerd is like a doughy white kid who it's like, nah, there's all is
so
everybody
different. So different. And I mean, I think, you know, not to blow smoke, but we have you, you know, in part to thank for that movement, because there was a shift. I don't know exactly when, but, you know, back in the day when we were kids, nerd, like Revenge of the Nerds, nerd.
Yeah, yeah.
Nerd was a pejorative.
Yes.
It's like nerd will get your ass kicked. Nerved, yeah. You're an asshole. Now, nerd, everybody wants to be a nerd. The hot girl puts on glasses and does cosplay. I don't know, guys. I'm just a nerd. well, you're the hot girl with glasses on and a short skirt.
But now the argument is like, Now the pejorative is like, you're a fake nerd. No, I'm not. I have real nerd credentials. What are you talking about? I'm not a fake nerd.
And then you have to prove.
Then you have to prove.
Oh, yeah? Well, what about, and if you could pass the litany of questions thrown at you by the guy that works at the comic book store, then you gain entrance.
That's how you know it all worked out well for the nerds, when people are defending their own nerddom. When before, be like, no, I'm not. What are you talking about? I'm not a nerd. I'm not a nerd. This stuff, no, this isn't even mine. Please don't hit me.
Football.
Yeah. Footballing is great. I love footballing.
Pigskin's awesome.
I never really... That was an interesting thing growing up. Because you're from Georgia, right?
Well, I was born in Georgia, but I'm really from Orlando, Florida.
You're from Orlando. Okay, yeah. Gotcha. But it was interesting growing up in the South and not being sports literate. Because there's so much sports. I mean, most people like sports, but particularly in the South,
it's a thing.
It's very tribal. And if you're not a part of it, if you're not a part of this school or this team or that thing, how do you fit? You know, like, where do you go? How do you, like, you're just sort of, you know, you're just part of the scraps that you don't know, like, where you fit in. So what was your group when you were growing up?
My group really was, I didn't have a group. You know, that's part of what my book is about is about being tribalist to a degree, which in the end worked out well for myself and for my therapist and for his kids because
they're all going to college.
Yeah, you're welcome, Timmy. Because of the neighborhood that I grew up in, I didn't fit in with the kids in the neighborhood in the hood. And then because I was bussed out to this other school, Dr. Phillips, which was, I would say, 98% white because of the gifted program. And that was I was smaller than the other kids because this is not nerd bragging. It's just facts. So I jumped from kindergarten to second grade. So I was already smaller than some of them. And being the smaller kid and not knowing the customs of this new world that you find yourself thrown into, and you really don't fit into your old place, I learned quickly, like, oh, I don't have a tribe, so I'm just going to be by myself. I've got my tribe. So that's why I read so much, and I started reading a ton of sci-fi, a ton of fantasy, and then plays and watching old variety shows and cartoons. And I think that's where I got my love of pop culture and also the classics, and that fed into me being able to do improv. So it wasn't until I got into high school, to be completely honest, that I found a tribe, especially like you're saying, in a sports world. I didn't play football. I was too small at one point. And then when I was big enough, I had no interest in it. So I ran track. And then I had no interest to really run track, but I did it so that I could look halfway cool.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So eventually I got into ROTC because my father was in the military. So I figured this is where I can hide out. So I can fit in here. And I like the costume. Only a theater kid will call a military uniform
the costume.
So I guess around 10th grade, I fit into that. And then in 11th grade, I started acting. And that's when I met the other kids who I got into the nerd culture of that time, like in 88.
Yeah.
Meeting the other kids that liked the Douglas Adams.
Yep.
And that we would listen to REM, but loved Run DMC.
Mm-hmm.
and the Beastie Boys and started getting in with those guys. So I think that's when I found my group and I found a voice.
Yeah, and also just sort of hearing about, even just hearing that much about sort of bouncing around in school and jumping ahead, and it's like, of course you had to learn improv skills. There was survival. Like, you had to learn how to survive in a lot of different environments.
Absolutely.
So you like, those are the roots. Like, you know, for every improv, you know, hoedown, there's years of, like, just trying to survive in a social structure.
Man, learning to freestyle and to come up with rhymes that not just weren't rhyming, but that made sense and that could cut someone down, that was self-defense. Learning that in the back of the bus as everyone's attention is focused on you and some guy is calling you asshole and saying, well, your mama and you so black, you this, you that, you had to learn to defend yourself verbally, because I had to defend myself physically, but verbally became the thing. How fast can my mouth be to get me out of this social situation so I don't look like such a nerd.
I mean, it's really interesting to like thinking, so you saying like, well, I didn't really know what my group was, and you're such a unique entity that I can imagine sometimes it can be hard to sort of for people to understand like what your identity is, because you do so many different things.
Right.
And you appeal to so many different people that I can see the plus side is like, well, you know, this guy is so versatile, he does all this stuff. And then do you ever feel like, well, I'm in between all of these different types of things, so I don't really know what, like, how to, you know, like in this business, you sometimes have to sell yourself one-dimensionally to a company. It's like, yeah. What am I? I'm a million things.
And I refuse to. And I mean, you know, the truth is, maybe if, you know, because I've been lucky enough since, I guess this is 2018. So since 1998, I've been lucky enough to be on TV. There has not been a year since 98 that I have not been on TV. That's almost unheard of. So I've been lucky that way. I'm sure that at some point in the first decade of being on TV, if I would have gone, okay, no, I'm this guy.
Right.
And rocked that direction as hard as I can. Who knows? Maybe I would have been doing more film. If I would have said, I'm going to double down and I'm going to release records and just be a singer, maybe I would have just done that, or Broadway or whatever, all of the things I've done. But at the end of the day, I don't want to do that. I will fight tooth and nail to my grave, never wanting to be just anything. No, just dot, dot, dot. And
right.
I think that's a holdover from being a kid and fighting so hard for my identity. When people would tell me what I am, I would say, no, I know what I am, and it's not that. And just disagreeing because I wanted to hold on to that, and I wanted to tell my own story, because so many people thought that they knew, like my folks are from the Virgin Islands, so we talked with an accent. And then I was poor, so this person called me poor. I said, no, I'm not. This person would say something, no, I'm not. So I'm very ornery still, still like to this day. So needless to say, sometimes I have a rough time in a room when I am supposed to be pitching a project and it's just me, and they say, oh, so you're going to just, it's like Marty McFly when you call him chicken.
Right.
I go, well, I am not just a host. Thank you. And then I proceed to get pissed off and regale them with my entire IMDb page of 9 pages. And that's no way to win friends.
Well, but when people try to tell you what you are, that's all 100% of the time about them, and they're sort of limited. You know, like people just need to file things in their head. They need to go, I need to sort this quickly and not give it any. And
so, because
it's easy that way. And however people see you is usually about them. I mean, unless you're punching them in the face, that's different.
Right.
But you know, when someone comes up and they go, "Here's what you are." A lot of times that's about them, and to understand that, I think, is really important, because, you know, if you're susceptible, or, you know, you might start going, oh, okay, well, I guess that someone just said, it's like, but what authority are they? You know, like,
right.
you should be comfortable with
who's that person. And so you need to be comfortable in your skin. And I'm not going to lie, it's a lesson that I'm still learning now at 46. I'm still maturing. I'm still undergoing this chrysalis stage, I feel, where who knows, maybe one day, if I'm lucky enough to be 80, right before my eyes close, I'll go, I've got it. I know who I be.
That's the cosmic joke.
Right?
That's the cosmic joke. I figured it out. fuck, he was about to say something. What was it? Nah, I don't know. We'll never know now.
And the world keeps going.
The world keeps going. That's important to remember, too, that's just part of it, that you're just – there's just some things we're never going to know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe we'll get this flash of enlightenment, like that white light you see right before you die is just all of the truth and information hitting you at once. But even if that's the case, like, well, it doesn't really matter because, you know.
Good news, bad news. Good news, here is the truth. Bad news, you don't need it.
I don't know if we ever talked about this. I think I remember auditioning for Let's Make a Deal when right before.
Yeah, you auditioned for one of the hosts for the host slot, right?
I think I did.
Yeah, Mike Richards auditioned you?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I was like, oh, we're going to bring back Let's Make a Deal. You are? Really? I loved that show. And I feel like I remember that whole process. And I'm just, first of all, I'm glad you got it. And I'm glad that it worked out so well. Because you never know.
Especially
with like, oh, we're going to remake this thing. You are. Well, good luck with that, you know. And it really worked out.
Man, it's amazing, you know, I don't know everyone listening your religious belief, but I have friends of mine that say, you know, the big cosmic joke is you tell God what you want and listen to him laugh at you, because we can set goals and it works. Hey, I'm setting my intention. I've got a vision board. And there are just times when you're not going to, when you're like, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah.
And this is awesome. And it could be good. It could be bad. With Let's Make a Deal, I'd been approached a few times. And each time I gave a respectful no thank you, because I remember at that time I just finished doing a game show on Fox, Don't Forget the Lyrics. Mm-hmm. And I only did that because I had a record coming out at the time and it was a music show and I could sing during the show. I was like, okay, this makes sense. I'm going to use this as a tool for this thing.
Yeah.
But I was one of those people that went, game show host? No, because in my mind, I had a cardboard version of what a game show host was, just like I have a cardboard version of what a weatherman is, or an anchor, or the guy that does the human interest pieces.
Yep.
That there are certain templates. Hi and welcome to the blah blah blah. Total 21, Johnny. Beep, 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 beep. He's got an all expense paid trip like that. That's cool for you.
Yeah.
But my ego. Like, I'm a classically trained actor. I do this. I'm not doing that bullshit.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. They came back a couple times. And then I met Mike Richards, who has become a dear friend of mine, the EP of that and of The Price is Right. And in talking to Mike, who convinced me to go to this lunch with Monty Hall to just listen, and I already knew I wasn't going to do it. I was like, I will go. It's pretty cool to meet Monty Hall. I used to watch the show as a kid.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And it's always nice to be wanted. Folks never lose track of the fact, even if you're in show business, I don't care if you're on night shift at Wendy's. It's nice when people think of your name and go, you know what? Why do we call such and such? You may never do the thing, but don't take it for granted. So it was an honor that my name was on this list, that a great company like Fremantle was like, oh, Wayne's our guy, and Monty Hall. So it's like, you know what? I'm going to take the meeting. I'll shake his hand. I'll get a picture. I'll send it to my mom. It'll be great. I sit down, and I meet Monty, one of the warmest people that I've ever met in this town. And we had lunch, and he started talking to me about Let's Make a Deal. And by the time we finished that lunch, I was like, shit.
Why'd I take this lunch? Now I want to do the thing.
I'm gonna do Let's Make a Deal. I just don't want to have a long microphone. And for half a season, they tried to make me use one. So I just don't want a long microphone. Because I just don't want to be that guy. And he said, I don't want you to do my show or to do an old game show. We want you to do it because of what you do. I said, so I can do comedy and I can do the musical comedy, and yes, do all the things that make you you. And I, to this day, I thank Fremantle and CBS and Mike and Monty for having the foresight, because to my knowledge, unless it's a specialty game show that is a comedic game show, I'm in a mainstream game show that does comedy, and it's basically a variety show with a game show element now.
Yeah.
And it's taken time to make it be that thing. But it's pretty damn cool. And a few Emmys later for it, it's turned into something. So no, you would have never told me that 10 years later, I would be hosting Let's Make a Deal in addition to the other things I do. Because I just never thought that would be the things. I didn't know it fit into my version of what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and also what you start to realize is like, well, there's no this idea that someone has to be one thing or another. It just doesn't even work anymore. That's just antiquated, like old media thinking. And you can host a game show. You can have a musical album. You can do musical theater. You can do improv. You can write. Like, you know, I almost feel like in a weird way, it's kind of expected now that you do 50 things. You
yes,
know,
it's because... good to be a multi-hyphenate, as you know.
Well, but it can just sometimes feel a little like, oh, am I enough of a thing, or am I not enough of a thing, or is it this? You know, and so I do find with trying to do a lot of different things sometimes that there is a little bit of an identity crisis. But I think that's the identity. The identity is sort of being in the middle of this identity crisis, and that's kind of what makes it.
And I mean, yeah, it's stressful sometimes, but it's cool. That is so cool. Like, I love having things in the pipeline as I'm working. Like right now. Of all things that I never saw myself doing. Now I'm on a soap opera for a couple months. I'm on The Bold and the Beautiful on CBS because I've got such a good relationship with CBS Daytime now. Because I was like, why not? James Franco did a soap opera, and he's a great actor, so I'm going to do a soap opera. I find out that the soap opera folks are great, and some of them are kick-ass actors, and the discipline to learn a whole script in a day and shoot it, I think it's awesome. Then I'm doing Deal. Then I've got Whose Line Is It Anyway? And we're working on a new record. And I'm writing this book that we hope to turn into a TV show. And my company has three shows in development with two different networks. And I'm a dad. I love being in the swirling maelstrom. Because the alternative is sitting at Starbucks with your laptop calling yourself a writer.
Right.
That's the alternative. So I like this. I really like it.
Is it enough? Like, do you feel satisfied by it, or do you ever have to check yourself before you wreck yourself? Do you ever have to check yourself? Do you ever have to check yourself so that you're not just doing stuff to do stuff, that you feel like, okay, wait a minute, I am satisfied. I do appreciate this stuff. These are all just things that I'm doing that are fun, and not because like I need it to feel like I'm somebody.
I'm never satisfied, and that is a problem. I think I need to live in gratitude more, but you always want more. Like, I've got these things going on. I want this movie that we're working on to go because I want to do more film. I want this sitcom pilot that we're doing with CBS. I want that to go because I want to do a sitcom. I want to produce. I just optioned two sci-fi novels. I want to produce those novels and see them actually work. I want to see a superhero thing go because unless I've got those things going, I feel like I'm not doing enough. And maybe there's something weird in that and not grateful, but that's the reality. I really, really love it. And I'm reading four books at any given time that I wish that I were doing. You know what I mean? But I think it's a drive. And I'd rather have that drive and bump my head into a couple walls than sit back. It'd be very easy right now with the living that I make if I were just a guy that wanted to host a show and be that thing.
Yeah.
It'd be easy. And then you do that and you Bob Barker yourself.
Yeah.
And nothing against Bob because that's what Bob did. Bob was the hosting beast.
Yeah.
Alex Trebek, the game show hosting beast. That's their thing and that's a legacy. But I think I'm working towards a legacy.
Yeah. I mean, just as long as you know, just as one person who does a lot, who probably works too much sometimes, just as long as you are doing it because you love it and that you know that you personally are enough, you know, that's what I would, that's
absolutely,
that's my I'm a year older than you advice.
but I've got to remind myself because I like that knowledge and to your folks, the folks listening, take that piece of advice. Don't chase something because it makes you feel, chase something because you can't live without it and it's your passion because there is a distinct difference.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I've done it the other way as well. So I'm glad that you said that. Yes, I've done it the other way where I felt like if I get this...
Then I will.
Then but people will, but I then, aw. So, no, that's the thinking that I'm trying to...
It's dangerous, because you can't control all that stuff.
You can't control it. Just like you can't control an audition.
Nope.
You walk in, you think, you nailed it. There's no reason why I can't be the next such and such. Well, yeah, the reason is because the director... you remind him of his best friend from high school that they had a falling out, and he hasn't talked to him in 30 years, and seeing your face is horrible. So from the time you enter the room, he's like, Joshua? And you're screwed.
Did that happen to you?
No, but
oh, that sounded so real.
Joshua?
No, I'm Wayne. I'm Wayne! I have to say, though, I went through the Whose Line audition process once. I mean, this would have been like 15 years ago.
Arduous.
And I got through a day. I got through the day. And it's intense, as you know, because it's a big group of people. You're in just like a, you know, just like a big conference room or a big meeting space. And throughout the day, they just make cuts. So you play a bunch of games and they make a wave of cuts. And I made it and I made it and I made it. I made it all the way to the end of the day. And I was like, holy shit. I'm going to get to be on this show that I watched when Comedy Central was still like the Comedy Channel.
Me too, yes.
And I watched every day, you know, like Clive Anderson and Ryan and Colin and Mike McShay and Josie and
Greg and all
Greg
those.
And
Tony Slattery.
Tony Slattery, yes. And Jonathan Pryce, like all these really great performers. And we get to the end of the day. I'm exhausted. I don't have any voice left. I'm more mentally tired than I've ever been in my entire life. And I get home and I call my agent and I go, I think I'm going to, you know, like I made it all the way. And she goes, great. They're just going to probably need you to do that a handful more times. And I was like, what? And then I go, you know what? I'm out. I did it once. I don't know if I have the fortitude to do that ever again. Like, it was 8 hours of improv games, and I just don't think I
can. But you must have slept so well.
Yeah, I might have slept for like a week, but holy shit. So I just, as much as I had respect for the show before, it gave me such a new perspective on what that process is and what it takes to make it on that show and thrive on that show. So hats off.
Thank you, sir.
What was your audition process? How many times did you have to go?
Well, in reality, I only auditioned for the show twice, and my auditions were spaced years apart. The first time I auditioned in Orlando with the sketch improv group that I was with. We had a comedy theater, which is still there. A shout out to SAC Theater. Probably one of the best improv companies in the South. And we auditioned. I realized the folly of us auditioning when we did. Improv, despite you may be a 17, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old phenom. Just witty. So smart. Look at you. You're dashing. You jump up on stage.
Yes, and the fuck out of it.
You can just yes and to everybody. But the thing that I've learned that I now try to pass on whenever I teach a workshop, every blue moon or I direct something, is I know the secret. The secret really is your improvisation is only as good as what you know. It sounds so simple and basic, but as an actor doing a scripted thing, you can fudge. You don't have to be in prison to play a dude in prison. But in improv, to yes and a certain something, if you don't know or have a bag of references to pull from, you can't make the space up. You don't have the ammunition. Life gives you the ammo. Each year, each thing you do, each movie you see, each book you read, each fight you have with your girlfriend or boyfriend, each person you watch do something stupid in public, each time you do something stupid, every news article, it all gets added. The bigger your chest of stuff, the better you are. I think I was okay by the time I got Whose Line. When I auditioned for it the first time, I think I was 19, 20. Horrible. I was horrible. I sucked so badly at that first audition, which actually, for those of you taking improv, is fine. You're actually supposed to suck when you're learning. It's a thing. You're supposed to suck. I was horrible. We as a group were horrible, and we thought that we were the shit, and we were horrible. So fast forward to years later, seven of us now live in Los Angeles, and we formed a group called the House Full of Honkies.
Mm-hmm. I know this group.
Yeah, like the Honkies actually got like a lot of shine. It was like the Groundlings and Second City and the Honkies came up. So they came back to see us again. I was so battle scarred from that first audition. I went, oh, hell no. Oh, I'm not going to audition for that. You guys can go and look stupid. I'm not going to audition. At the time, I was working as Dracula and Wolfman in the Beetlejuice rock and roll show up at Universal Studios.
Fantastic.
Singing five times a day, singing to rock songs and breakdancing as the werewolf and singing Hot-Blooded as Dracula in this Broadway-esque show, monsters singing Broadway and rock songs. But I sang the shit out of that. I was awesome. And I was a percussionist at the park in this thing called Boom Operators. And I sang doo-wop. And I was Cab Calloway in the Blues Brothers show. I was going to keep a gig. I was like, I will not be waiting tables. Nothing against waiting tables. But I wanted to act. So I was doing that. I said, I'm not going to go to this audition because I'm working my shift. At that point, I was making as much during the day as someone doing an equity show on the road in Los Angeles. That's not heard of. So I went, I'm not missing out on that money. Come on, Wayne. So as part of the group, I gave away a couple of my shows and I said, I'll be back by my lunchtime because I'm going to get cut. So let's all show up. I have to preface this that there were seven of us in the House Full of Honkies. Acknowledging myself, I believe I was the least funniest person in the Honkies. My job, yeah, I was funny. I did my thing, but I would do the music piece. I had characters, but there were guys in the improv group. And if you're in an improv group, you know the people I'm talking about that were the stars. They did their thing. And I was happy to let that happen because I had my other interest. I wanted to act on TV, so the stage thing was cool. So I just showed up figuring that me, as the seventh in line, I was going to get cut. I showed up. We all do the first round. Oh, great. I'm still here. We do the second round, like you're saying. We do some more of the games. And those games, I don't know about you, but those games scared the shit out of me because I would watch them do World's Worst mm-hmm. on TV and Mike McShane and Greg Proops. So fast. It's like, how the hell? World's worst example of a bus driver. It's like, I don't know. Your stop is, you know, oh, I don't know. But it's amazing what adrenaline and some fear will unlock in you. Because somewhere between the third and fourth round, I actually wanted the gig. And everything that they threw at me, I have to admit, I was on point. And it just kept happening. I called in and canceled the rest of my shift at work. I gave away my shows. The same thing that happened to you happened to me. It was an 8-hour day at the end of it. But the difference was they kept calling me back in by myself to just do musical stuff. That they had a whole two rounds where it was just me. And then they'd bring in somebody else to do it with me. And they wouldn't do so great. They'd be, okay, thank you, thank you. And I would just, can you do Michael Jackson having an epileptic seizure? Yes. That's where I really embraced yes and. It's like, hell yes. Yes and. What do you want? Yes, I'm a dinosaur. Captain EO, I love that.
I just coincidentally am wearing a Captain EO shirt.
I love that.
You drop a Michael Jackson.
Anything that they said, I did. I was in it. And at the end of the day, the smoke cleared. There were only two people standing. It was myself and my dear friend Claire Sarah, who is now a big-time Ha Hollywood writer. She just wrote that movie, and I'm going to butcher the name of it. Is it Smallfoot? The cartoon. Smallfoot. So it was just the two of us. And then you think you've got the job. They said, all right, well, we'll see you Friday. That's wonderful. The agent went, oh my God, this is – I'm actually going to be on Whose Line. I'm actually going to – whoa! We'll see you Friday for the workshop. For the what? You went to a workshop. Now, I didn't realize that that workshop was where you really get the gig because that's the first time I met Ryan. I met Colin, and I think Greg Proops was the other one. They, of course, had already been doing the show, so they were la-la-la-la smoking cigarettes. Me – I knew that I had to tap dance and backflip my way into a gig. So I treated it like I was doing a show. I was Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, you know, in that one cartoon where he's sliding on his knees and he's got his glove.
And he gets no applause.
And he gets
and
no
Bugs
applause.
Walks out and he goes, "And what's up, Doc?" And everyone's like, "Yeah!" Everyone freaks out.
I was Daffy. I was working my ass off. And I ended up getting it right after that. And that was my very first. And then I got my first episode. And my first episode, I was made a regular immediately after my first episode. So that's a long-winded way of describing what happened. And it's one of the most amazing weeks of my adult life, of my life ever, because I never saw it coming. And when it came, I was actually ready. And I didn't know that I had gotten ready for doing improv. I didn't know that I was ready because I'm the last person that I would have ever thought would make a name for himself doing improv. Never thought.
That's two jobs that you were like, I know I'm not going to audition for this. I'm not going to, I don't want to do this. I'm not going to. And then wait a minute.
See, I'm stubborn. Like I said, I'm really stubborn.
But it also means you don't always, not only you, but you in the general sense, don't always know what's best, like what your thing is.
You don't always know what your thing is. And there's nothing like thinking what your thing is. And we see it on American Idol all the time. I'm Jimmy, age 23. I'm from Long Beach. My thing is, I'm going to be the next Snoop. All right, then. Let's hear you, Jimmy. Bow-weezy. Y'all like peppermint. Rockin' it. Understand. I'm the man. Who did? Thank you. What? That's my baby. He can rap and sing. It's okay, baby. Mama, they didn't like me. Well, no, Jimmy, because your ass can't rap or sing. So know your thing. You're right. Know your thing. That's just for life. Know your thing.
Or at least just be open to discovering or be open to the experiences that, you know, because it's so easy to prejudge. You know, it's like, oh, that doesn't sound like anything I could or would be interested in doing. It's like, well, but what if you just tried it? And if it doesn't work, then you have proof that it's not the thing for you. But what if it does work? Or what if it unlocks something that you hadn't expected before? Because we're so obsessed with building these fake security bubbles where our feelings never get hurt and where we can, you know, like the game is always set on easy difficulty, and we never
infinite lives
God mode, and we never have to be afraid of God mode because there's no growth in God mode. It's just you're not getting any muscle.
Not at all. And that is a good rule to live by. I think, you know, it's an improv thing, but yes and is real. Shonda Rhimes, I think, wrote that book a few years ago, The Year of Yes. But my thing is, yes and, I think, is even a little more powerful. Because you can say yes to a lot of things, but can you yes and it? Can you, yes, I'll audition for that thing. And I will take that opportunity and use it to go someplace where I'm not comfortable.
Right.
That's really powerful.
Well, and Alan Alda was on the podcast earlier this year, and he had talked about how he would go in and train groups, like scientists, people who were not comedy people or performers, in to play improv games.
Because yes, we do the same thing.
Yes, yeah. Because it forces them, or it just naturally opens them up and makes them comfortable in situations where they're not, and it also gets them to trust their instincts and not get in their own way and get all the judgment out. But improv training is the best. I mean, like, stand-up's one of those things, like, you're either going to do stand-up or you don't do stand-up. But improv, you can, like, stand-up training is just going and doing it. But improv training, I think, prepares you for almost anything that life could, you know, like, any discipline. It's so interdisciplinary.
Because it's fluidity of thought and it's fluidity of self, and being able to not be so locked in. So when something pops up on, I always describe improv when I'm doing it, I've got a computer screen up in my head. And whenever I have to make a choice, or whenever I hear a word, like if I'm rhyming or if I'm doing a song, I'm seeing all of the different options that I can go to. And I have to make a decision immediately, but I've got options. I've got all these things that I could. No, that doesn't work. Am I going to use that? Ooh, I'll try that. Let's see. If I didn't think like that, if I chose to think in a purely linear fashion, there's no way that I could stand on stage and pretend to be an eagle on his way home from work. You know, I mean, like the most absurd situations, and try to bring some sort of reality to it, because I couldn't process it. I couldn't process being that open to those things.
Yeah.
And I think that training works. When I was with theater sports out here in LA, or when I was with SAC, and even privately, you can teach a businessman. You can teach people that are in charge of Fortune 500 companies to trust their employees by doing the trust exercises. It sounds so cliche and actory, but you can teach that way of thinking. And it's so cool to watch someone who would never, ever get on stage, by the end of the day, actually be somewhat decent at making choices. It's really cool to watch.
Yeah, because it's so easy to... I feel like life can give you so many reasons for why your choices are bad. Life can show you so many, you know, if you're looking at that perspective. And so you can get very afraid, not only because of past experiences, but also just like, I don't want any new shitty experiences, you know.
I like the old good ones.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, just like being too comfortable in a bad relationship, or too comfortable in a bad job, or too comfortable in a, it's like, you know, sometimes people will choose familiarity over the risk of being uncomfortable or being hurt. But the reward, you know, even if just the reward is like, I broke out of a mold that I was in, it's worth it.
Amen.
I think.
Amen.
You know, and but the truth is, so many other things come along that, because you can't, you just don't know what things a path is going to reveal to you until you start down the path. You just can't possibly know. But at least if you're open to it, you know, like, well, a lot of, because you, I'm sure in the last 10 years, all the opportunities you've had, all the things you've gotten to do as a result of these decisions that you made, you never could have foreseen all of that.
Never.
But they wouldn't have happened if you hadn't done this.
Never. And I think the thing, and this is talking to some of your older listeners, at 30, that the fear is, and I think the fear that you have to let go of is the fear of running out of options. I think that's what helps people stay in whatever situation they're in. I was talking to a friend the other day, and I think it's no matter what job you're in, and talking about, you know, the guy that you were talking about earlier, who was 50 and left that job. On paper, you're 50. You've been doing this for 30 years. You're going to start over now?
Yeah. A whole new thing?
You're going to start over a whole new thing. Who's going to hire you? So that's a fear. The fear of options. Well, I'm 50 at this point. I don't have any options. I'm sure it's easy. And not everyone is going to have a success story like that. But I'm sure at that age, even at this age, if I were to start over, or I wasn't doing X, Y, and Z, yeah, you'd go, oh, shit, well, I can't be the 25-year-old guy running around on camera with my shirt off and abs all the time, and I can't do this. I can't jump out of a friggin' plane and join the Army. Whew, I need to do something. That's fear-based thinking, because you're afraid that your options are running out, instead of just taking a breath and being open to the options that are in front of you. And we don't see those all the time because we're scared. And I speak from experience. I will be the first person to panic if I feel that things aren't going right, because I have a deep-seated fear of failure, which drives me. It's like, no, I don't want this to go wrong. But that deep-seated fear of failure, while it spurs me to do good things, I think, also can stop me sometimes. So I have to take a breath. I have to look and go, these are your options. Even if it's only one other option, shit, it's an option.
Yeah, but you can never fail. You can't fail, because anything you do is going to have something valuable in it. Even if it doesn't, in a traditional sense, like, well, this thing wasn't number one at the box office, or it wasn't this. I mean, if that's how you define success or failure, then yeah, that's outside your control.
Right.
But if you can figure out how to define success and failure as an internal process and not an external process, you can never fail, because you can always learn from something. It can spur you in a different direction. You can appreciate it just for the experience that you had.
Yep.
You have that much more wisdom. You have, even if it's just that, like, there are so many things to extrapolate. And like with this guy, you know, what's so fascinating was that
for him, it sort of felt like he was starting over, but he said, and I thought this was so interesting. He was like, yeah, and you know, because I had all this marketing experience, I put together a business plan. I was like, that was it. You like that like all that time gave you the experience to put together this plan to manifest your passion. And if you hadn't had that 30 years experience, maybe you wouldn't have known how to create this business.
Right.
But you still, it wasn't just like that story was over. You were still able to call upon that tool set to manifest this bigger thing that is so much better because you had that 30 years experience. So it all like, it all factors in if you're, you know, if you're looking in the right place.
If you're open to that, and it's really hard. You know, it's one thing for us to be able to sit down and say that. And I know that there are some people that are in the hustle, and sometimes it's a little harder to see that thing because you're like, oh shit, I have to make rent.
Yeah.
But from what I've seen, some of the people who have kept their heads during the days of, oh, I've got to make rent, are the people that eventually get to a place where they have more than they thought they would because they did exercise that kind of thinking.
Yeah, and it's like with improv or going on stage, you know, it's the buildup of just like anything, like, oh my God, I don't know. What if I don't have something to say? What if this fucking sucks? What if this? What if this? What if this? And then you get out there and it's like, well, you fucking figure it out now. You know, like you're in it
yes.
now. You've made the decision to jump into it. So you are going to figure it out somehow. And, you know, obviously sometimes it's not going to result in huge laughs or it might not work out exactly the way that you had hoped. But the fact is you did it. And it's so empowering to know that you're so much more capable than most people give themselves credit for. It's like once you're in the fire, you'll figure out how to get out of it.
That's exactly it. And if you do it more and more, here is a thing that I think I've found. If you just jump out and do it, you give yourself a certain confidence after a while that your established baseline is always going to be like walking on stage and doing improv. I'm pretty confident in saying that my baseline, to me, if I have a show, it's still going to be a funny show.
Right.
No one's going to leave going, oh, I thought he was funnier on TV. Than, you know, like I hope, knock on wood. Because my baseline, I've done it enough. I'm enough of an outlier. I've done it so long that I have a certain confidence about it. I'm still scared shitless right before I step up, but I'm okay with that, and I use that. So my baseline, after doing it for so long, is going to be here. Some nights, the greatest show I've ever had, and then other nights, you know, there was a drunk couple in back that kept saying, joke a bitch, so I had to deal with them, and I didn't like it, and it took me out of the show, but the audience still is going to like it.
Yeah.
So I think you just have to, like you said, you have to keep doing it. You just have to keep going and challenging yourself until the challenge becomes not getting out and doing it. The challenge then is, oh, okay, I just got out and doing it. Now I'm open.
Right.
The challenge is I just got out and did it. Now I'm open. And now I'm going to throw another challenge at myself. Make it interesting like that. And you can definitely apply that to life.
Yeah, because getting into that flow state where now where you go out on stage and you're in the middle of a rhyme and you see the screen come up and all the options and everything slows down and you have the ability to, you know, where it feels probably incredibly slow to you, but it's happening so fast to the audience.
Yes.
But your skill level and comfort, like once you can get all that anxiety and all that neurosis and shit out of the way, you really can start, you know, picking and choosing and forming and that's the magic. Like those are the moments, but you can't get there until you just get out. Like you said, and you just get out. Okay. You got on, you did it. Okay. Now you do it again. And for me, I don't know what would have happened if I had done another, like, I don't know. I think I wasn't confident enough that I would survive another day of full improv audition. And I didn't think that, I just thought,
I don't know. I feel like I got lucky this time. I feel like I'm not going to be able to survive this, but who knows? Like, maybe I would have surprised myself.
Who knows? And you would have been the Who's Line guy instead of the Nerdist guy. But I think everything worked out just fine.
Oh, my God. When I met – it did work out. It did work out just fine. But I'm telling you, like, the first time that I ever met Ryan Stiles and Colin Mochrie was, like, they were two of the – and this was well into my career. They were, like, the two biggest celebrities. It's like, the people that influence you.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have met Jack Nicholson and be like, oh, that's so cool. But meeting Ryan Stiles to me was, like, that was heart-stopping. Oh, you know? Like, man. Like, that kind of thing. And you are that for people, you know? Like, you get to be that for people. So, I do, I hope, you know, it's because sometimes we run around in circles a million miles an hour and we sort of forget. It's like, oh, I just got to do with all these things and perform, and I don't know if I'm doing a good job. But, you know, part of this legacy that you're creating has already been created. You know, it's like there are people out there that want to do comedy because of you. Or there are people, you know, there are other young kids who live in the hood who are like, oh, I don't know, comedy isn't a part of my life. But that guy, he did it, so why can't I do it? You know what I mean? Like, I can be a nerd. I can be this. I can be a, so.
I love that. I've met some of those kids, and it's brought me to tears.
That's why it's so important for you, I think, to do all the different things that you do, because there's so many different ways that people can be inspired by it and then go off and do their thing. You know, I mean, it's just we're just part of this carbon cycle of creativity. You know,
I love that, man. I'm gonna check back in with you because I don't know your schedule or if you'd even be interested. But we go back to work. We have 2 weeks in February on Who's Line. I think you should come and play. I really think you should come and be our guest.
Oh, I just felt my testicles like absorb up into my stomach.
No, but you would be our guest.
Oh, so I, okay, good.
Yeah, so you would be.
I'd have the training wheels on.
You would be protected, but still have fun and come and do scenes and a song and stuff. It's so much fun.
I remember I was in college at the time. I went to UCLA, and there. How long have you lived in LA?
Since I think 96 or 7.
Oh, since 96 or 97. There used to be an improv in Santa Monica.
That's the first place that the Honkies worked out of with Second City as well.
Okay, so in like 92 or something, I was in a group at UCLA, like a comedy club, like a bunch of writers and. Like a bunch of people, we'd help each other write material and then we'd perform in the dorms and stuff. And for whatever reason, I ended up becoming – I met Rick Overton and became friends with Rick.
Wow.
And I knew Rick from – because I was an obsessive stand-up comedy nerd. And he was like, oh, you should come down to the – we do these improv shows at the Santa Monica Improv. You should come.
That's awesome.
And I went down one night. And I was there with the girl I was dating at the time, and I got called up on stage, and I only did one. We were playing Freeze, and I had one joke in, and I almost chipped a tooth doing it because I had my mouth around a stool, and it got a laugh, and then that was it. I was like, I'm done. Like, I just didn't want to get greedy because I was so terrified that I was going to fuck it up the next time. And that's for you to saying that to me. I just go back to that. I'm like, I don't know if I need to get greedy about this now, even though I just said that you need to get on stage.
See, and now this is the thing.
You've literally just called me out on my own advice. Like, here I am trying to be all like suave about like you, what you got to do, and then you're like, do this. Oh, I don't know, Wayne. I mean, I'm not so sure.
No, I couldn't possibly.
Oh, I mean for other people. I don't mean for me.
Well, just know that the invite is open.
Now I have to do it because I have to do it because if I don't, then I'm not following my own advice.
Well, I think it would be absolutely amazing. And so I will make the call as one of the EPs.
Oh,
I think
Jesus,
I can get you on the
amazing.
Show.
Oh.
That would be awesome.
This, and also would just, you know, I mean what you might call a lifelong bucket list dream. Of being on that, you know, being on the stage.
Well, then we got to call and get your schedule and make sure that you can do it.
Did you ever – are they still doing it in England? Do they still do it in England or have they not done it for a while?
No, they haven't done it since when they brought it here in 99. In 98, that's actually when I did the British one for the first time. I did a few British ones and that was the end of that series.
So you did the British version?
Yes, but
I mean,
did it
that's,
here.
Oh, you did it here.
I did it here, so it was a cheat. But years later, I got a chance to work with Josie,
oh.
and And I've worked with Mike McShane, and I've worked with Clive. I didn't get a chance to work with Tony. I wish I would have. Their sense of humor, you know, especially at that time, it was radically different. It's a radically different show, doing Who's Line There, and then when we took it over. And I think I was partially responsible for that, because I think when Dan Patterson, the creator, saw the kinds of references and things that, especially me, I guess being one of the younger ones at the time, we come from a very physical background, a lot of music, character voices, big characters, being able to turn on a dime, not like the Who's Line thing then of everything was very clever. It was very clever and fast. I talk like this. I'm Tony Satterby. Well, that's interesting. You know that? Well, I don't know. Would you?
It's me, Clive Addison, say goodnight. Goodnight.
It's goodnight. And then credits. It's yeah. Like, wow, that show was fast. This is like this became a different thing. So I guess I'm kind of responsible for the dumbing down of Who's Line.
No, but you know what? No, I got to say.
I'm a superhero. Rocket ship, space noises, Wayne Brady, samurai.
Lasers. You know what they don't talk enough about on Who's Line? Pie and NASCAR. We're going to fuck this shit up.
Woo. Comedy.
I can't understand what they're saying on that other one, but this one,
this shit's funny.
I get it. I fucking get it. But anything that translates, the common mistake that I think gets made when a British show gets made on American television is that they try to copy. It's like, you know, anything that has worked, that started as a British show, you know, The Office or Who's Line or fucking All in the Family. It's like,
yeah,
they have to make it. You have to take the seed of the idea, but the cultural vernacular is different.
It's so different.
We say a lot of the same words, but our sub language is different. Our cultural language is different. So you can't, like, the types of jokes that work over there work because that is a part of British culture. And you might, if you're an Anglophile, you might appreciate some of that, but you can't really. Yeah, exactly. You know, we can laugh at Monty Python over here, but do we really understand it? I don't know, you know? And so it, like, on the level of, you know, having been a part of the, you know, like, an indigenous British person. So I think it's important that you guys did that. And I think that's why it worked, because you weren't copying.
We couldn't
exactly
have done
what they did.
And I think we took it from a different place. Who's Line, to those of us that watched Who's Line here on Comedy Central, I think it was niche. It was very, very niche. It was nerds and theater kids and people that appreciated the games and liked the Britishness of it. When Who's Line came here, there's a reason why people in Kansas, St. Louis, Florida, Compton, wherever, know Who's Line, because it became so broad, because we spoke the language and the show had a certain speed.
Yeah.
So I think it worked out well. It became what it needed to be for here.
It's kind of funny to hear you say, like, oh, the old Who's Line was niche, but when you think about what television viewing numbers were in, like, 1992, 1993, niche on Comedy Central was probably still a few million people. It's like the number of, like, the niche audience from 1992 would keep a network show on the air now forever.
I know. Isn't that something?
It's just, you know, we gotta crawl to the four corners of the internet to find our audiences anymore.
Times have changed.
So all your different audiences, do you find that, like, the Who's Line audience is a little bit different than the Let's Make a Deal audience? It's different than this audience and that audience and the Bold and the Beautiful audience. Like, is it, you know, are you sort of the middle of this pinwheel of all these audiences, or is there a lot of crossover?
There's overlap depending on the project. That, you know, a lot of the people that watch, the weirdest crossover is Housewives and Let's Make a Deal, and stoned college students and Let's Make a Deal, and kids home on vacation, little kids. Then there's an overlap from the college kids to Who's Line. And then any of the sitcom stuff, like when I was a semi-regular on How I Met Your Mother, that's just broad. And some of the dramas that I've done, that's niche. Like Colony was a sci-fi thing, so yeah, only these cats would get that.
Yeah.
And so I think I'm kind of like the elephant and the three blind men that each had a different take on what the elephant was,
yep.
and they didn't know quite what it was, but they knew in their mind what it was. So there are people that like the improv. There are people that like the game show comedy. There are people that know the Broadway stuff and that know the sitcom stuff. So I'm lucky that there's a little bit of overlap in everybody. And the people that don't overlap, they still come to see whatever it is that they like.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's, you know, and again, it's a little baked into being a performer and innately wanting people to like you and be happy and like what you're doing. But, you know, when you first start out, it's like, I need everyone to like me. Everyone's got to like me. This doesn't work if people don't like me. But then I think the more you do your career, it's like, well, what do I want to do, you know? Like, if you want to do a soap opera for a few months, do the soap opera if it makes you happy. If you want to record an album, record an album if it makes you happy. Make a movie. Do this. Do that. And then I think once you're so set and confident and comfortable with yourself and your own choices, the audience will fall in line. Like, they'll follow you because the people who are your true fans will get –
yes.
Oh, this is all a part of a bigger thing, and this is a journey, and this is a fun trip.
Bingo. Even industry-wise, I think the big fear that I've had is, well, if I do this thing, then I'll never be one of the cool kids and be on a cool sitcom. And da-da. You know, I, at a certain point, I realized, it's like, you know what? They're not paying my bills. Maybe I'm not going to be a cast member on the cool kid indie sitcom of the day, but I have people that will come to see me anywhere I go in this country. They will pay good money for tickets to come out for an evening to watch me because of whatever the hell it is that they've seen on TV. So that's something that I just had to let go of. That, well, the industry will think I'm to quote the Murtaugh from Lethal Weapon, I'm getting too old for this shit. I don't care anymore. I'm going to do what I think is cool, and somebody will come to it.
I appreciate that you used his character name, by the way. That's true. That was the real deal.
Thank you, sir.
Riggs,
come here. Is something in your throat? Danny Glover, is something in your throat?
I don't know what you're talking about. I need a lozenge.
That's all he needs. All Lethal Weapon is he just needs Riggs to give him a fucking lozenge.
See, there should have been a rewrite where he gets a lozenge. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, you guys, I feel so much better.
Oh, I am getting too old for this shit.
You know what? I thought I was, but I think I'm the right age for this shit.
I'm sitting on this toilet bowl.
I am the perfect right age for this shit. But what was the thing you were saying, right? Was it like people following you around? Like, it's just sort of knowing that there's real power in being you, and the more you are, the better off you're going to be. Because just like when people say the internet will or Twitter will or this, it's like, it's not a person. It's not run by – there's not even an organized central body. It doesn't even – it's like getting mad. It's like freaking out about what an ant colony is. You don't know.
The Twitter council.
Yeah, exactly. So like with the industry, it's like the industry, there's no president of Hollywood.
The show business.
Yeah, exactly. You can fucking do whatever you want. Like this is – you know, this is more than ever. This is our time to forge the thing that we want and go, okay, well, you don't get this, but I get it. And I can connect to people that do get it. And we don't fucking need you, and industry.
I'll say, you know, you still manage to be an inspiration. Like
me?
I look at
I
what you. Absolutely.
Oh, thanks, man.
Absolutely. I look at your hustle and I see what you've carved out for yourself in a space where it did not exist. That's just the coolest thing to carve
I appreciate that.
To carve a passion. And I remember years ago, I think right after your first book came out, we ran into each other somewhere. And I told you that I read it. I think we're at a park. Maybe I had my little girl with.
Were we in New York? I feel like I was in New York or something.
Yeah, I think it was in New York.
I was blown away that you knew the book.
And I knew the book, and in reading your story, because I think I'd also met you years earlier when you were describing the first time when you were filled with this angst and you were just, oh, life sucks and this thing and blah, blah, blah. And I remember meeting you during that time and then reading about what you did and then seeing things. I went, you see, things happen. You made that happen. You made that happen. It'd be very easy for the guy that didn't write the book to have stewed, simmer, sat in his own crap and who knows where that guy would be. So I just have to say, as a fan,
it's so cool. I really appreciate that. I honestly, you know, I think there was an inherent blessing in not feeling like, and I'm sure you feel this way too, about not feeling like you fit in anywhere. So I say, like, for anyone who feels like they don't fit in, get excited, because it, you know, like, because when you are thrust out on the stage, you will figure it out. And the more rejection, you know, it's like, I feel like my career anyway was just the result of a lot of rejection. It's like, well, I got to make my own stuff. And yours is probably like, I don't think I fit anywhere, so I'm just going to make stuff. And so if we had very early on been placed into the machine, the industry machine, and gone the traditional way, we probably wouldn't have been as fulfilled. There probably would have been an expiration date. We wouldn't have learned how to absolutely adapt, evolve. And so I think, you know, for both of us, like, what a blessing to not feel like you fit in, because then you have to fucking make your own mold.
Thank you, the show business.
Thank you, the show business, for years of rejection.
Amen.
But in general, like, you feel good, you feel happy, you feel like everything, you know, who are, when people tell you, like, they go, you're this, you're that, who are you to you?
You know what? Today.
Yeah.
Because that's what I can, because that's what I can speak on, is the way I feel about today. I feel like a great dad. I feel as soon as I leave here, I'm going to go meet my daughter at the mall, and we're going to have lunch and then go to an appointment and hang out. I feel like a guy who is working on his craft, to sound all artsy, and has really rediscovered in the past few years passion, as opposed to fighting and going on autopilot. I've discovered my passion, and my passion is to create. My passion is to create things that live outside of me that I don't have to be in, and I love that. And I get inspiration from other people. There was a time when I felt like I was being a hater because I didn't like what was going on with me. So fuck everybody,
mm-hmm.
even if they were friends of mine. Well, fuck that dude. I'm so mad. You got a walk of fame, got a star. Screw you and your star. I don't want to watch your movie. You suck. I don't like you anyway. Now I can give love and appreciate and go, yeah, I'm happy for you because what's mine is mine.
Good. Well, just, you know, I hope you internalize and appreciate the fact that whatever you set out to do as a performer, you've achieved it. And now everything else is just sort of like bonus, you know? You just get to do it because it's fun, not because, like, you're not going to exist if it doesn't, you know?
Right.
It's like you just get to do it because it's fun.
No, my name's in the history book somewhere, so I think it's pretty cool.
Is there anything you want to plug, promote, anything you want people to know about besides Let's Make a Deal, Bold and the Beautiful, Whose Line coming back?
We have, you know, like I said, look for these projects. I'm really, really excited. I wish I could talk more about them, but as you know, when things are in development somewhere, that's the curse of death, is to actively. But it's, I would have never thought I would have had three separate things that people have bought and said, we like this, let's make it. That is, I wake up grinning. So definitely in the next year and a half, look for my name to pop up as the creator and executive producer of a couple different shows, one of them a drama. And I've got a new record coming out first quarter of next year. So if you're an R&B fan, and I'm working on a comedy R&B record as well.
You're working on a comedy record, a comedy R&B record?
Mm-hmm.
What is that about? I need to know more about that.
Yeah, that's going to be tied into that
to the
Young, Gifted, and Whack.
Cool.
So that's a whole project. So it's kind of like I'm making a throwback record that would have played on the radio in the 80s and kind of been the soundtrack to this nerdy little black kid's life. So I'll be writing those songs.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on everything.
Well, thanks.
And, it's always great to run into you. And I, you know, like, this just reminds me, like, we got to just sit down and hang out more often, even when there aren't microphones around.
That's what I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree.
All right, good. Thank you so much for being here, Wayne Brady.
Thank you, sir. Bye, y'all.
The end. I just started the recorder back because I just handed Wayne Brady the D&D book that my friend Kyle Newman was a part of, Art and Arcana.
Hey, Kyle.
And it just unlocked this insane story that I wish I had heard on the podcast about a tiny little Wayne Brady in history who made his own D&D modules, for fuck's sake.
Because I didn't have any money, and the guys at school, I was too nerdy for the cool nerds. So instead I went home and I got notebook paper, made my own graph paper, made my own little wax figurines, and I wrote up my own adventures. And I had to teach kids in my neighborhood to play, so the only people that would play with me was this one Mexican kid named Carlos, who thought he was a ninja. And then there was another kid named Eddie from down the street who was a bit of a gangbanger. And together, oh, and my friend Jacques, and we spent half a summer playing my bootleg DVD, and by the end of the summer, they were fully invested.
D&D, like, your bootleg D&D.
Yeah, like my bootleg D&D and me making up rules. Oh, and another guy named James from down the street. And
God,
it was just so cool that was my little group during the summer.
God, that's fantastic that you made your own D&D.
Yeah, man, you don't need graph paper. Make your own graph paper. Make your own axis.
Make your own graph paper is a fucking great message for life. You know what? When life doesn't give you graph paper, you make your own fucking graph paper.
Absolutely.
And I had two copies of this book, and I've just gifted you the Dungeons and Dragons Art and Arcana book, and it was so great to like watching you flip through it and just see your eyes light up and the recognition. And so
because all of the memories came back. All this book, I'm going to read the hell out of it, so thank you. Like, just know that this is a gift that I will definitely appreciate. There's this thing that I've been trying to get together, but I've been too busy. But I think it would just make me laugh and make me happy. I want to do this thing called R&B D&D.
You get to sign that book.
That's a fucking great idea.
Where I get all these, you know, just random music people to play a game of D&D, but I want the soundtrack to go along, and as DM, you know, you can do certain things to make sure that there's a musical performance or something as you enter the tavern, and just a way to just have these people that you would never go, why the hell is, what is Bobby Brown doing playing D&D?
Okay, I'm gonna
like guys that are D&D fans.
I can help you manifest this idea if you're serious about it, because I know the D&D people, like the people who, the company that runs it and owns it.
Dude, I think it would be so, because it'd be like one of those parties. It's almost like at midnight, where the whole excuse of it is just, it's going to be dumb,
yeah,
but it would be so fun and stupid, and like almost like a variety show, a great way to play the game, get conversation out, and you could break new artists if you wanted to.
What a fucking great idea!
Well,
it is.
If you like it,
you just said the words R&B D&D. I'm like, why hasn't somebody done that yet?
Well, if you like it, I would gladly do it with you.
Well, I'm gonna give you my info.
But just the initials made me laugh, and then once I got past the point of it, went, oh, you know what? It's not just a funny initial sounding. This actually could be entertaining.
That's the hook of it is that the title is great, and then on top of that, there's a substance to the idea. It's not just a sketch. It's not just like a SNL sketch.
Right.
It's like a real thing that people would watch. I think that's fucking great. That could be like carpool karaoke for nerds. That's people who like R&B.
That's the perfect pitch. And I'm thinking that it's like guys like, now this is when I feel old, but I understand the market. You have guys that are young and savvy, like you know, like that one rapper, Lil Yachty.
Yeah.
Huge fan base, the whole thing. You bring someone like him on. Of course he doesn't know how to play the damn game and do the whole thing. But what if? Like, what if he actually did, and he's truly a nerd, and you can ask someone about being a nerd?
I guarantee you're going to get some guys on there.
And then you're going to find out, like, oh, they're fucking...
Drake has played D&D.
They're really into this shit.
Yeah. Like, I read someplace, Drake has definitely played D&D, and there are people that if you find those folks that lock in with the younger audience, and then sometimes you can get an old school act that has a lot of appeal. Like, I would love to get Snoop on, and it'd just be funny to watch him smoking up and then ask him to play a game.
Yeah, and, you know, like even if guys come on and they're posturing and like about halfway through, I bet you they would start to like lean in and like get into it.
Oh yeah,
like, fucking like really lock into it before, because if the magic of it is, if you're, because it takes so long to play, if you're there for a couple hours, you can't keep a facade up for that long and still pay attention to what's going on. So it would drop. And I think that's where the secret sauce of that show is just like watching that moment where you're like, it just dropped. And then they're like locked in and they're playing.
That would be amazing. That would be amazing.
Well, I'm glad we turned this back on for a little addendum to the end to hear about your D&D module and make your own graph paper, people.
That was the ID10T podcast number 1006 with Wayne Brady. This is Word Salad Wrap. And I feel very compelled to talk about two different things that were touched upon in the episode. Number one, pursuing avenues that you never would have expected. Not just Bob from Wellbred in Los Alamos, who changed his life. I mean, I probably wasn't on a dime, but for all intents and purposes, it was on a dime. He completely changed careers. And then also Wayne, who two times was not open to things that ended up becoming amazing things that changed his life and ended up flourishing in ways he never could have possibly imagined. That was Let's Make a Deal, and that was auditioning for Whose Line. And so be open to things. When your natural defenses first go up and you go, I don't think I could do that, go, well, wait a minute. If I could, maybe what if I did? And not just saying yes to things in life, but also, as Wayne said, to say yes and, you know, maybe take an improv class. It could, you know, even if you think it's not the thing for you or that you're not amazing at it, it still could open you up in ways that could change your life, that you can take those tools you learned in the improv class out into the real world and, you know, and sort of infuse them into your daily choices. But also, talking about Wayne and the idea of identity and on ID10T, but if you do a lot of different things and or if you do something that's different or new and people don't know how to categorize it or how to categorize you, I think that's usually a really good sign because it means that you're doing something fresh. And there's often a lot of resistance to new, fresh things. Much in the same way that you resist making new and fresh choices in your life, other people, the world, the internet, will resist new and fresh ideas if you put something out there that they don't necessarily have a frame of reference for. So if you do a bunch of different things, they might try to categorize you as one thing. Don't listen to them. That might mean you're on the right path. But the more things you do, the more different things you pull together, make up the unique creature that is you, that is different to anyone else in the world. So embrace all of that. Don't be afraid if someone says, I don't get that. That's weird. That's new. You actually, that might be the best thing ever because it means you're on the right path. I've done things before. I've, you know, like done work stuff before. People are like, what are you doing? That's dumb. I mean, look, this is the dumbest and most obvious example, but when we started Talking Dead, this is dumb. Why would anyone start a show that talks about another show? This is stupid. Maybe you still feel that way. I don't know. But it seems to have worked. And then within a year or so, people were trying to copy the idea. After shows were popping up all over the place. Some of the same people that said ours was that we were stupid for doing it. So it just, if you get that kind of resistance, like, I don't know what this is, or this is dumb, or I don't know, what is this? I can't tell what this is. You might actually be on the right track. Maybe you're not. I don't know. But I'm just giving you this bit of advice so that you don't immediately bail out on something just because of an initial reaction. Initial reactions are protective. Initial reactions are the brain's, like, immediate defense response. But initial reactions don't always they don't always have the ability to think things through. They're just trying to protect you. Sometimes it's your gut telling you that a situation is bad, and that's good. You want to listen to that. But, you know, with your creative endeavors, maybe that sometimes that initial response is a defense mechanism that isn't necessarily helpful. So when you do get the defense mechanism shields that go up, just take a step back and ask yourself, wait a minute, is this really a bad or unsafe idea, or is it just that it's new and different and there's no frame of reference for it? Should I pursue this anyway? Is there a way to pursue this? Is there a way that I can manifest this in different and unique ways? And there's a
good chance that a percentage of the time the answer is going to be yeah. And so, like I said before, if you start putting stuff out there and people don't understand it or they don't know what it is or they shit on it or whatever, get excited. As Lydia says sometimes, she'll go, get excited, because she's just a beam of positivity and light. But it should give you some comfort and also let you know that you might actually be onto something. So don't give up so easily. Trust your passions. Pull all the different things together that you love. Be the most unique version of you that you can be. And don't fucking listen to don't listen to the haters and the shitters on people who shit on things. Don't just don't. I know it can poke at your insecurities, or it sort of pokes at like, oh, this is what I didn't want. No one wants to be told that what they're doing is dumb. But if you can give yourself some space and separate that from yourself for a minute, focus on the process and focus on what you're passionate about and not so much as on the result of what other people are going to say, then, like I said, you might be onto something. So thanks for listening. I appreciate you, and I'll see you in your ears real soon. And also watch Whose Line Is It Anyway on the CW. And please, if you think I suck, don't tell me, because sometimes it's hard to follow my own advice.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women have been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor, Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.